On the record today in case number 81142, Brass versus State of Nevada. And we're scheduled for a 30-minute argument, and we did issue the order scheduling the argument, said it would be limited to the one issue about the motion to substitute counsel and to be prepared to address the court's decision in the Patterson case. So with that being said, Ms. Westbrook, are you ready to go? Oh, you know, I should say I have Justice Herndon with me here in Carson City courtroom, and obviously Justice Pickering is there in Las Vegas right in front of you. So, Ms. Westbrook, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
Okay, and so as you're probably well aware, what will happen is you still start at your full 15 minutes, and you'll get the yellow light and the tone when you get to your 3 minutes, but the time keeps running until you, you know, say you're actually reserving the rest of it.
Wonderful, and it's okay to take my mask off. I just want to clarify.
Yes, you can take it off while you're speaking at the podium.
Wonderful. Helps with the glasses not getting fogged up.
Yes, I totally get that.
May it please the court, justices. I'm Deborah Westbrook from the Clark County Public Defender's Office on behalf of the appellant DeQuincy Brass. The district court violated Mr. Brass's Sixth Amendment rights by forcing him to go to trial in a 22-count child sex case where he faced more than 100 years in prison with a retained attorney who failed to prepare for trial and who had conflicts that clearly warranted the substitution of counsel. Now, as the court knows, our briefing addressed the standard for substitution under Young versus State, and that's a case which focuses on the right to effective assistance of counsel. And the court has asked us today to address the Patterson versus State case and the standard for substituting counsel based on a different Sixth Amendment right, the right to counsel of choice. So I'm going to begin today by addressing the interplay between Patterson and Young and explaining why Patterson doesn't really alter the legal analysis in this case, but simply offers an additional basis for reversal. Patterson recognized that all criminal defendants, whether they're indigent or non-indigent, have a right to effective assistance of counsel. But only non-indigent criminal defendants have a right to counsel of choice. And when a defendant seeks to replace previously retained counsel with court-appointed counsel, Patterson has said that the focus is on counsel of choice. Now, even though counsel of choice is the focus, that doesn't mean that the right to effective assistance of counsel goes out the window or that it's not relevant. In this case, both rights were implicated because Mr. Brass retained his attorney, and that attorney was unprepared to defend him, and he had conflicts of interest. The only difference between the Patterson and the Young test for substitution is that Patterson does not require a threshold showing of good cause for substitution, whereas Young does. But if you look at the cases relied on by Patterson, which are the Rivera-Corona and Ortiz cases, both of those cases recognize that good cause has a place in the analysis, even if it is not a requirement. Whether this court applies Patterson or Young, the analysis is really going to be the same. When addressing the timeliness factor, the timeliness of Mr. Brass's request, the district court had to balance Mr. Brass's interest in new counsel against a possible disruption from the substitution, and the district court was required to conduct an adequate inquiry to make that determination. In this case, we are arguing that Mr. Brass had a significant interest in obtaining new counsel that outweighed the need to go to trial in February of 2020. In other words, he had good cause in this case to dismiss his attorney. And we're arguing that the district court failed to conduct an adequate inquiry in the face of overwhelming evidence of good cause for substitution. I also want to point out in the court's written order, which is in volume one at page 168, finding number nine, the court actually considered the fact that Brass had retained his attorney as a factor that weighed against the granting of his motion to substitute counsel, which is an additional basis for reversal because the court essentially held his right to counsel of choice against him. So I'm going to start first by talking about the clear evidence of the irreconcilable conflict that existed at that second Young hearing, which demonstrated good cause for substitution. Now, most typical Young hearings involve just two parties. You have the defendant that is making accusations about the attorney, and you have the attorney who's either going to fall on their sword or they're going to defend themselves. And a court can pretty easily, in most cases, listen to the two parties and reach a conclusion about who's telling the truth and who is not. But this case was different. Investigator Robert Lawson came to court to corroborate all of Mr. Brass's concerns. Lawson has been an investigator in over 200 trials, and he told the court that Mr. Brass's attorney had, quote, literally no knowledge of this case, and that Mr. Brass wasn't, quote, getting any kind of a defense. Lawson described the investigation that he had done, the exculpatory evidence he had uncovered, and the fact that Mr. Brass's attorney hadn't followed up on any of it. He didn't issue any subpoenas. He didn't notice any witnesses. He didn't talk to Mr. Brass about his testimony, whether he would testify. And he wouldn't get back to Mr. Lawson about the investigation itself. At this hearing, Mr. Brass's attorney didn't deny Mr. Lawson's accusations. He admitted he focused on attacking the state's evidence rather than presenting our own evidence. But after meeting with Lawson the day before trial, he started to reconsider his approach, and suddenly he realized, maybe obtaining exculpatory evidence might have been appropriate or even necessary. That's when the court recognized this is a problem and told Brass's attorney it, quote, had a lot of details from Mr. Lawson that basically you haven't done anything. And that was since the court had given him a continuance the prior May. That's when Mr. Brass's attorney confirmed that all he had done to prepare for trial since May was review the state's evidence and transcripts and prepare potential opening statements and cross-examinations. The whole reason for that May continuance was so he could find an expert, so he could issue subpoenas, so he could notice witnesses, and he didn't do any of it. The court had only granted that May continuance because without that continuance, the court said that he would have been ineffective because nothing had been done to prep the case. The court was aware of this history. So the court asks him point blank, if everything or a substantial portion of what Mr. Lawson and Mr. Brass have told me is true, then do I need to refer you to the state bar? That statement is key. That's the court acknowledging that there was an irreconcilable conflict that apparent from the record at this point. And that would have been the time for Mr. Brass's attorney to come clean to the court and admit that he had been subject to bar discipline for similar ethical lapses. Under Rule of Professional Conduct 3.3D, he was required to inform the tribunal of all material facts that would enable the court to make an informed decision, whether or not those facts were adverse. But instead of coming clean about his bar disciplinary history, Brass's attorney three times begged the court not to send him to the bar. And that's when he claimed he had a strategy, that he'd made a strategy decision to ignore the exculpatory evidence that Lawson had found in his investigation. Given the record in this case, there was no basis for the district court to just take this attorney's word for it that he had a strategy. There were too many red flags, and the court needed to dig deeper. At the time of that second Young hearing, there was also evidence in the record of an actual conflict that would have constituted good cause for substitution as well. Under the U.S. Supreme Court case Wood versus Georgia, even if Mr. Brass didn't specifically raise the actual conflict, the district court had an obligation to investigate it because there was evidence in the record indicating the conflict existed. In Clark versus State, this court said, a conflict exists when an attorney is placed in a situation conducive to divided loyalties. And here, there were two actual conflicts that were apparent from the record. One we've just spoken of at the Young hearing, when Brass's attorney begs the district court three times not to refer him to the state bar, and instead of asking to withdraw because he was unprepared, he puts his own interests first before that of his client. The second other conflict that we identified in our brief was Mr. Brass's attorney allowed the third-party payment arrangement that he had with the family, with Mr. Brass's family, and that payment arrangement interfered with his ability to adequately represent Mr. Brass, and that violated Rule of Professional Conduct 1.8F. And specifically, we know the fact of that payment arrangement was in the record, and the fact that the payment arrangement was causing interference. That was also in the record and available to the court. The first time the arrangement interfered with the relationship was in March of 2018, shortly after the preliminary hearing in this case, which was when Brass's family initially did not continue making payments after the prelim, and Brass's attorney moved to withdraw without speaking to Brass about it. He was communicating only with the family, the people that were paying. So he failed in his duty to communicate with his client, did not tell his client that he was filing a withdrawal motion, and then the client appears in court, and suddenly that's the first time that he learns that his attorney is seeking to withdraw. Now, ultimately, I think the family ended up paying, and he ended up continuing the representation. But it only got worse after that. And the most obvious example was when the state made some critical items of discovery available in July of 2018. And this discovery included transcripts and videos for all of the key witness interviews in the case, forensic interviews. It included months worth of jail calls. It included Sunrise Hospital medical records for two of the child victims. And the ROCs from the state are in the record. It's in volume one of the record at page 104 to 107 if you want to see what that discovery was. These are items that he could not have gone to trial without. And he admitted at the calendar call that he had not picked up those items of discovery because he was waiting for the family to pay him. This is an admission that the third party payment arrangement was adversely affecting his representation of Mr. Brass. And at that point, given that admission, the court should have taken him off the case, but instead it granted that second continuance and allowed the conflict to persist. Under both Patterson and Young, the district court was required to conduct an adequate inquiry into Mr. Brass's request for a substitution, and it couldn't just take counsel's word for it that he had a strategy. If you look at the Gallego case, which is it predates Young, but it addresses the sort of inquiry that the court needs to undertake when determining whether there's good cause. And that involves a determination of whether the attorney's decisions are reasonable. So the court here should have asked some key questions. How did this attorney decide on his strategy? Why did he ignore the investigative leads?
I have a question. Do you think that Young overstates the conflict issue analytically? Patterson doesn't refer to it, but I wonder whether, and I'm not disputing your assertion of a conflict in this case, but when you read Young, it seems as if it's really leaning on this conflict issue. But I can imagine cases where that shouldn't be given great prominence in the analysis.
So I think the reason the conflict is such an important issue in Young is because you're dealing with an indigent defendant who is appointed counsel, and it's you know, an indigent defendant doesn't have a right to choose which public defender is going to be representing them. So there's more of a focus when you're dealing with the right to effective assistance of counsel, being able to show that counsel is ineffective. In that context, I think it is necessary to establish good cause. And that's why the cases sort of differ in terms of the right to counsel of choice. When you have a timely request that's made, you know, early in the proceedings, you're not going to be looking so much at whether the attorney was effective or not. You're focusing more on the defendant's right to autonomy and the right to choose how their defense is going to go. And I think so there's kind of a continuum. If it's an early made request, like in Patterson, where it was made at the preliminary hearing before much had happened in the case, then the right, you know, or the concern about a conflict is less of a focus. And really, you know, the idea is that you can discharge your attorney for any reason or no reason, if it's somebody that you've retained. But when you get to the point where it's later on in the proceeding, and that second factor, which involves timeliness, it's a balancing test. You balance the defendant's right to choose their own attorney or their need for the attorney to be taken off the case against the disruption that it would cause. And so in this particular case, I think the fact of the conflict was very important for the court to look at. And, you know, it's really going to kind of depend on the timing of when the request was made in any given case.
Ms. Westbrook, if
yes.
I might, thank you. You can't really establish a very, very strict formulaic approach to that, right? Because those hearings, whether it's a Young hearing or a Patterson hearing, the court has to have the flexibility to kind of follow what's occurring, because it'll be a lot of times the first time the court is aware and questioning people about the issues. So separate and apart from whether the court's decision was right here or whether they adequately explained what their decision was, it was a pretty lengthy hearing involving not just representations from Mr. Brass, but as well Mr. Posen and an investigator who, quite frankly, said some things I've never seen before. So are you saying you don't think the court did an adequate inquiry in this case, or that you're asking us to establish more specific types of inquiry that a court should undergo?
No, I think this is a very, I'm sorry, Your Honor, are you finished?
Yes, I am. Sorry. Thank you.
Okay. Well, what I think is that this is a very fact-specific inquiry. And the in general, the court has to conduct an inquiry that's going to be sufficient to tell the court, as in Gallego, that the attorney's decision was reasonable. And if there is any, if there's evidence in the record indicating that the attorney, you know, didn't have a reasonable basis for doing what they did, I think you have to kind of get into some of that specific, some of the specific strategy decisions and maybe dig a little deeper when you have objective evidence in the record, as you do in this case, suggesting that the attorney was not diligent and didn't do what the attorney needed to do. So I guess I'm getting close to my my time running out. I want to say that the two things the court did wrong here is they did not conduct an adequate inquiry given the factual record in this case. What we're essentially asking is not for a blanket ruling that would apply to every case, but just in a finding in this case, given what the court knew about this particular attorney and what they could have found out if they went to the State Bar website, for instance, this inquiry was inadequate. There was so much evidence that he was not prepared and that Mr. Brass's constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel was violated when they didn't grant the substitution. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So you have 31 seconds left. I'll add an extra 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll, of course, add 2 more minutes to Mr. Chen's time as well.
Thank you. May it please the court, Alexander Chen representing Respondent State of Nevada. First, I want to thank the court for addressing the issue and identifying the issue that it wanted to hear today. I believe I speak for both of us in saying that was very helpful for us in preparing. That being said, nobody wants more competent counsel than the state of Nevada. And that might sound strange, but the state of Nevada realizes that ultimately, not only will we have to go to a trial, defend the case on the merits, and then ultimately go to post-conviction, where we're going to have to defend an ineffective assistance claim, which is inevitably coming.
Yep.
So the state of Nevada has a great interest in ensuring that counsel is effective. But we're not here today under a post-conviction ineffective assistance of counsel claim. We're here today to address the idea and whether the district court abused its discretion when it denied this very untimely request to remove Mr. Posen from the case. When I look at the facts of this case, I wonder to myself, what more could the district court have possibly done to try to figure out what was needed and what the correct decision was? The record clearly indicates that Judge Hardy reviewed the Young case, reviewed the Garcia case, and made specific inquiries directed by this court as to each of the three requirements that are pertinent under Young. When I hear things such as, well, he had a conflict of interest based upon his financial interests. Well, I'd like to say a couple of things about that. First of all, the motion to withdraw by Mr. Posen was filed in late 2018. It was in November of 2018. The preliminary hearing was in March. It's very common for us to see a private counsel file such a motion when they're not retained past the preliminary hearing. If a district court is to remember in 2018 that this motion was filed and then apply it all the way to 2020 when the calendar call is happening, that would be an undue burden upon the district court to have that responsibility to somehow remember that this motion was filed. And because these motions are so common that, of course, private attorneys want to get paid, a potential conflict of interest would exist for every single defense attorney except for my friends across the aisle, the public defender's office. They're the only ones who are paid not based upon a retainer, but upon the work, upon their job and their duty to their clients. Otherwise, every time a defense counsel has an issue with non-payment, we would be left in a position where the court would have to determine if there's a conflict. And what's worse than that is the state has no bearing on the financial interests of the defense counsel. It's not the state's fault. It's not these victims' fault. It's not our responsibility or our fault that for some reason the counsel that defendant has personally chosen or his family is unable to represent due to a financial burden. Yet here we are today where the repercussions could potentially be that because there was this financial arrangement, which is common in so many cases, that the state of Nevada and the victims would be the ones punished for the conduct of the private attorney and the decision of the defendant.
Chen, let me ask you a question real quick, and this may be an uncomfortable position to put you in, but I think it's an important question. Obviously, Ms. Rhodes was not present during the hearing that Judge Hardy had, in which Mr. Pose and Mr. Lawson and Mr. Brass represented on the first day of trial everything that was going on. You, however, as a prosecutor, had you been in the room and heard what was said, would you have still objected to a continuance of the trial or the motion to substitute counsel?
Because
now been able to look at it, the transcript of all of that, and saw exactly what it was that transpired.
I would say in this case, Justice Herndon, yes, if I had been there, I personally would have moved to go forward, and this is the reason for that. In reading both Young hearings, and even the motion to continue in May of the year before when they were set to go to trial that Monday and all of a sudden the trial got vacated. In all of those hearings, when you look at specifically what was it that needed to be done, and when we go to Strickland analysis and we try to figure out what was the prejudice and what was ineffective about everything, I still don't to this day understand what it was that wasn't done or that needed to be done. And that comes from whether it's from the defendant or appellant himself to Quincy Brass, that comes from Investigator Lawson, that comes from Posen. I don't know to this day what the conflict was. I've gone through the transcript. I've looked at the extent of the record. I've seen that there were claims that certain information needed to happen. But at no point do I actually see what evidence, witnesses, leads specifically required them to go to trial.
So, Mr. Chen,
yes.
Sorry, Justice Kadish in Carson City. So let's talk about that. I mean, obviously, as a trial judge, I heard lots of requests by defendants trying to fire their attorney and claiming they didn't do any investigation, they didn't file any motions. And when you say, well, what witnesses and what motions, and then you talk to counsel, and it turns out, you know, the client isn't an attorney, doesn't know what is appropriate or not to file, and most of the time, it doesn't have merit to it. But, and perhaps that was even the case with what Mr. Brass said at the calendar call here. I'm more concerned about what happened at that sealed hearing the morning of trial when Mr. Lawson gave much more specifics about information that he thought was worth following up, records to subpoena from the Apple store, that he thought there was more records to be subpoenaed related to the Palms Hotel, and I think more important to me, the failure to subpoena CPS records that potentially would show some credibility issues regarding the accusers here, or at least one of them. And so at that point, it seems like it got more specific than just Mr. Brass saying, my brother should be a character witness, right? Can you respond to that?
Yes. And at first, when I had read about, before I knew anything about the facts of the case, and I had seen that there were these Apple records, for instance, that Mr. Lawson wanted. So I thought, okay, yeah, if he works at the Apple store, that could potentially be an issue.
And the mom of one of the victims, who was his girlfriend, worked with him.
Correct. Correct, but my understanding from the facts when I actually read the facts here is that they were working from home, or at least he was working from home in large part as well. He's part of Apple, getting paid by Apple to work at home and answer phone calls that get routed. So if you have a problem and you need help with your phone, you call the Apple number and that actually gets routed to the appellant at his house. So this isn't an instance where we're saying that he was at the store, so it's impossible for him to commit anything while he's at the house. Even had they gotten the records in this particular case, he still has the ability to do things while he's in the home in which he's living. And I would point out as well, I know Investigator Lawson made these claims, but the only reason that the appellant even decided to raise this issue in the first place is not because he felt personally that Mr. Posen wasn't doing his job. It's only because Investigator Lawson is the one who brought it to his attention. In fact, Mr. Bress, when he's asked in court during both Young hearings, he has very little to say. If you look at his motion where he's requesting to remove his counsel at the calendar call, or actually after the calendar call, but when you look at his motion, he has very little to say as well. Justice Kadish, he says things that you're used to seeing, as you mentioned, when you were handling trials, which is very vague claims of things that his client, his attorney didn't do. But the only reason we're here in the first place is because Investigator Lawson, who again isn't an attorney, he doesn't understand the strategies that were used
for
trial.
But Mr. Posen, who is an attorney, didn't dispute what he said and said, oh, now that I talked to him this weekend, I finally understand. Yeah, maybe I should have followed up on that. I mean, that's kind of crazy stuff to come out in a, you know, you got a guy facing over 100 years in prison. So that's a serious concern.
I agree it's a concern, but it looks to me like Mr. Posen almost had cold feet in terms of, yes, this is a serious case. He had been preparing to go to trial. Now it's actually here, and he's again looking for a way to get out of it, just as he did in May of 2019, just as he did at the calendar call, just as he did on the first day of trial, where he's always trying to get out of the trial.
So, but you, the court, sorry, I apologize. I just want to clarify. You're saying Mr. Posen wanted to get out of the trial?
He had said he was seeking a continuance request again at the second Young hearing.
I just wanted to clarify if you were referring to Mr. Posen's motivation or Mr. Brass's motivation. I just want to be clear.
I think it goes to both. I think Mr. Posen, even if prepared, such as we came into court today, were there nerves for both of us coming in? Absolutely. Sometimes you wish you had some more time to continue going over things, and you'd like that time, but it's not necessarily the case. Certainly, I understand this is a stressful situation where Mr. Posen was on the brink of trial and potentially wanted to do more, but that's always the case. You could always potentially want to do more. The question, though, is, was it timely? Was there an actual conflict? And was the court in a position to adequately assess whether or not Mr. Posen was ready to go to trial? And
when Judge Hardy issued his ruling, and he talked for quite a bit in reading the transcript, and it was very clear that 75% of that was focused on the idea of the disruption to the court and the prejudice to the victims because of continuing a trial, which is obviously a concern, right? And then he talked somewhat about disagreements between Brass and counsel. It seemed to me that he did not really address the prejudice to Mr. Brass himself by what was going to be caused by having to go to trial with Mr. Posen in the state of things as they were. Do you think he addressed the prejudice aspect sufficiently in that ruling? And if so, why?
I do, because what he said was, in listening to the arguments of all parties involved, including the investigator, he felt that this boiled down to strategic decisions rather than actual evidence that needed to be produced or that needed to be investigated.
Okay, what was the strategic decision, though? Go ahead.
The decision was that Mr. Posen was going to cross-examine these witnesses on inconsistencies in their testimony, which he absolutely did. If you look at the work and the questions that were actually performed, there were a number of inconsistencies that he still was able to point out. However, even at the end, when Judge Hardy sentenced the defendant, he indicated that at first he had concerns, but upon actually witnessing the performance that Mr. Posen did in trial, he A, thought the evidence was overwhelming that the defendant would be found guilty, and B, he thought that Mr. Posen did his job to zealously advocate for his client. And I think that the judge was in a good position to do that, not only to assess everything that was at the Young hearing, but to see the job that was actually performed in trial. And I should also point out that Mr. Posen did get not guilties on two of the counts. Yes, he still had guilty verdicts on the other counts, but the fact of the matter is this wasn't a case where Mr. Posen did nothing. He was able to effectively cross-examine and present a defense.
Let me just push on that a little more. So I would agree that when you have the attorney saying further investigation or other witnesses aren't needed, that my strategy under these circumstances is to attack the state's witnesses and their credibility, that can be a legitimate strategic choice, which would not be challengeable and would be appropriate decision for counsel to make. But I get more concerned in this case because of Posen even acknowledging that at that final hearing that, in fact, he now realizes after talking to Lawson, finally, after being unreachable, that that he actually now thinks, I think some of that would be necessary to do a complete job, right? So now it's no longer just a strategic dispute between counsel and attorney. It's now attorney acknowledging, yeah, he's right, I should have done more investigation.
Well, Justice, I would respectfully say that, again, I chalk those comments up to the fact that certainly there were a lot of nerves going into this trial. But imagine, and I'm not saying that happened in this particular case, but again, as a trial court, you're aware that oftentimes defense counsel's motions to continue will be based upon the fact that they would be ineffective if forced to go forward. So then the state's left in a position where the defense is asking for continuance and it's going to be granted because, again, we want effective representation on our side. Mm-hmm. But imagine now you have a record where every defense counsel would be motivated to essentially say the magic words of either ineffective or I need more time. Mm-hmm. And you could never force the state to go, mm-hmm. or force a case to go to trial, right, because you could always make these excuses. And I'm not saying that there was any ill will in this case,
right,
but I'm saying that if you're building a record as an effective defense attorney and you want to give your client as many possibilities for relief as possible, why wouldn't you say this?
What would be a strategic reason not to subpoena CPS records that potentially show a prior false allegation by one of the victims?
Well, I think that he was aware of the, if I'm not mistaken, I thought that he was aware that she had changed her story, and I think that's where he was going to go. Originally, it was directed towards a cousin, but then later it became directed towards the defendant, and I think the state in its case explained why it was that change occurred, but that was still an inconsistency, which clearly he cross-examined her on. So, again, in every case, I understand that more could always be done, potentially, but I do think that in this particular case, I mean, the court was at a loss. It was continued in November 2018 over an objection. It was continued in May. The court did everything it could to have monthly status checks almost to babysit right. this case more than I've ever seen. And then all of a sudden, we get to February, and Mr. Lawson had been in all these, Mr. Brass had been in all these hearings, and all of a sudden, they're saying or claiming that nothing's been done. And if I could just finish my statement.
Go ahead.
And yet, nothing apparently has happened according to the record, but I think that they were ready to go to trial. And I would just like to leave you with this. Again, as I mentioned, this is something where the state had no dealings in terms of the reason for the result here. What I would say is, if this court does find it necessary or finds that it's warranting of a reversal, then I don't understand how this attorney or any attorney who acts like this can continue to practice in the state of Nevada.
I have a question, Justice Kadish, if I might.
Sure, go ahead.
How do you deal with Patterson and Young and their application in this case? If you were analyzing this case, what would you say on those?
Well, in looking at it, I see Young as the controlling case. When it comes to Patterson, that seems to be about choice, and he got to choose his attorney. He got the attorney that he requested. Again, for my concern would be that there could always be a delay tactic where all of a sudden the defendant, who also could have cold feet, fires his counsel of choice on the eve of trial under the guise of that attorney hasn't done the things that he wants the attorney to do, and then a new attorney would get appointed, and we would be another 2 to 3 years out from ever trying that case, and I don't understand how that would be fair.
And do you think then that Patterson misstates when it says if you're going from retained counsel to appointed counsel, you apply the Patterson test?
I don't think it's a misstatement. I think you can read both of them together. Just
okay.
Agreeing.
That's what yeah. I, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chen. All right, Ms. Westbrook.
Thank you, Justice Gatish. So I think ultimately it does come down to the timeliness factor is going to be key in this case. And unfortunately, I think there's sort of a misunderstanding as to what that timeliness factor entails. It's not just when did the request get made. The timeliness factor, if you look at the case law, if you look at Moore, if you look at Young, and if you look at Patterson, you're balancing the defendant's interest in counsel against the disruption flowing from the substitution. So you're not simply looking at when the request was made or what prejudice is going to happen to the state. You are doing a balancing test. And in this case, the court had to consider the evidence that was in the record of good cause for the substitution, and not just the fact that it was going to cause a delay, which I think Justice Herndon pointed out, that was a large part of what Judge Hardy focused on was the timing, the fact that he thought that it was a ploy and that this was going to cause prejudice to the victims and to the state. Citing Garcia in this case, the district court improperly found that Mr. Brass's request was a ploy. Unlike Garcia, Brass had an investigator who came to corroborate his claims. This was not just a he said, she said, or he said, he said type situation. So we know that it wasn't just a ploy. Unlike Garcia, where there was no actual conflict, this court was on notice of all of the conflicts. The court was aware of the history of this case that had been tortured and long for 2 years, where clearly the attorney in this case wasn't doing what he needed to do. The court could have asked this attorney to withdraw earlier when it became clear that he wasn't doing what he needed to do because of the financial arrangement with the family, because he hadn't been paid, so he didn't get that discovery that was crucial. That was all in the record. That was all available to the court, and that was not a factor in Garcia at all. It wasn't Brass's fault that his attorney didn't work up the case and kept asking for continuances. He's in jail during this whole time. He doesn't know what his attorney is doing. And so when he comes to court for status checks and his attorney is representing, yes, I'm doing what I need to do, I'm following the court's order, even though the DA at a couple of these hearings pointed out, look, I haven't gotten any notices, no witness notices, no, it doesn't look like anything's being done. Everybody kind of knew that something was going on, but this my client essentially was trusting that his attorney was doing what he was supposed to be doing, and he reasonably relied on the representations that were made to him. In this case, because Brass's attorney had actual conflicts and because he failed to adequately prepare for the trial, Sixth Amendment rights were violated, and the substitution should have happened. The trial should be he should get a new trial at this point.
And
thank you.
And your time has expired, but I'm going to ask you a question anyway. So just obviously the court was concerned, and appropriately so, it's certainly part of the analysis about, you've got children who are purportedly victims of sexual abuse having to, which is like the worst kind of witness to prepare, and they go through trauma, and they've done this multiple times, and it's gone on several years, and they're getting older, and, memories fade. All those things are legitimate concerns. So even if we take into account your client's prejudice from proceeding with Mr. Posen, under that balance, persuade me why the balance still tips in your client's favor.
Well, I would say in U.S. versus Moore, the Ninth Circuit held that if a relationship between a lawyer and a client completely collapses, the refusal to substitute counsel violates a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel and warrants a new trial. So ultimately, the most important concern in that balance is going to be if we can show, which I believe we have shown, that there was that irreconcilable conflict, there were conflicts of interest, he did not have meaningful representation at that trial. And because of that violation, that tips the scales. That should control in this case.
And
notwithstanding the prejudice to the state.
Mr. Chen's argument that, look, you know, he did. He cross-examined the witnesses. He pointed out inconsistencies. He got not guilties on two counts. Did he do enough?
I don't believe that he did. And I think, you know, I know we were limited to this individual issue, but I had raised other issues in the case based on things that Mr. Posen had actually done during the trial, one of which was allowing the jury to see the DA's notes that you know, indicated that, you know, he had stalked one of the victims, like highlighting materials in the notes. There were materials sent to the jury that were one of the victims asked that he get the death penalty. These are things that if an attorney had actually reviewed the discovery and had reviewed the materials like he claimed he did, that would never have gone back to the jury. And he would never have stipulated to that. So right. I don't feel that he had a fair trial.
May I ask a question as well?
Sure. Go ahead, Justice Herndon.
How much, if any, do you think the court's focus should actually be on what happened at trial? I mean, we're looking at the decision that was made pre-trial about whether to substitute counsel. So should that be viewed in a vacuum, or should the court even be looking at how counsel performed once the trial began?
I mean, I think the court could look at what happened at trial. I don't think it's prohibited, especially under the United States Supreme Court's decision in Greer, you know, that discusses the plain error standard. You can look at the entire record when you're trying to address a situation that happened at one particular hearing. You're not limited to the contents of that particular hearing. So the court could look beyond it. I don't think the court has to look beyond it, though, because I think there was enough evidence in the record at the time of the Young hearing that should have put Judge Hardy on notice that this attorney was not prepared and would not have been able to effectively represent his client.
Justice Kadish, I have a question also.
Sure, go ahead, Justice Pepper.
Thank you. We have to look at this from an abuse of discretion standard, viewing it from the decision that the district court made. And what I'm hearing you say is that you disagree with the district court's assessment of what was presented. And the issues could be left to a subsequent post-conviction proceeding. I mean, ordinarily they would be if you're talking about ineffective assistance. So, and I'm not hearing you say there was a misapprehension of law in the standard that the court applied to its analysis, rather that it didn't adequately appreciate the facts it was presented. So could you clarify in what regard you're saying there was a reversible abuse of discretion in this pretrial decision?
Sure. The reversible abuse of discretion in this case was the analysis. I mean, there's two factors that you look at under Patterson. There's the timeliness, which again is that balancing test. So I'm arguing that he did not balance correctly, and he should.
But that's a classic defer to the district court balancing.
Except in this case, there was so much evidence of a conflict that he did not consider, and he didn't properly undertake the analysis that he was supposed to take at that second step, the investigation. He's supposed to inquire. He's supposed to conduct an inquiry. And given every bit of evidence that was in the record that was before him, he didn't ask the necessary questions. And it is, in this case, a very fact-specific analysis. This is not, you know, as my colleague has indicated, if the court finds for us in this case, it's not going to open Pandora's box to every single defense attorney being able to just say, hey, I'm not ready. And then the court's going to always have to defer to that, or else there's going to be a reversal. I mean, this is such a unique situation, given you know, given the fact that you had that second individual there, the investigator Lawson, corroborating everything, every concern, and the fact that the court didn't ask the questions that were necessary in this case. So, you know, one of the other things I would say is an absolute abuse of discretion was his reliance on the fact that Mr. Brass had selected this attorney, and actually putting in his order that, you know, because he chose him, that's a factor that weighs against substituting counsel at this point. That's legally incorrect. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you so much for your briefing and argument on this case. This matter will stand submitted, and court will be in recess.